I've called this talk Letters of Gold, for reasons which will become obvious perhaps at the end, if I get that far. So the Dhammapada is probably the best known Buddhist scripture throughout the world. It's part of the Kudaka Nikaya, the lesser or minor collection of anthologies. And in the Pali language, it consists of 423 verse aphorisms. Pada, that's the word that translates verse aphorisms, on the Buddha's teaching, Dhamma. Hence we get Dhammapada. It has also been called by various translators the Way of Truth, Footfalls of the Law, Statement of Principles, which I rather like, although I'm not sure I understand it yet, and Verses of the Law. These 423 verses embody ethical and spiritual precepts. Speaking of the Dhammapada, Banti says, the depth and universality of its doctrine, the purity and earnestness of its moral teaching, and the sublimity of its spiritual ideal, combined with the refined simplicity and pellucid poetical beauty of its language, win for it an honoured place in world literature. Quite a sentence. I had to look up pellucid, and I know some of you aren't native English speakers, so I'll tell you what it means, because I had to find out as well. It means transparent or translucent, extremely clear in style or meaning. So it's the pellucid poetical beauty of its language. So there's a clear and transparent poetical beauty to the language of the Dhammapada. You have to do this with Banti's writing sometimes. You have to sort of look up words in the dictionary. But I think that's really good, because it means you increase your vocabulary, which is never a bad thing. In the English translations, we now have more than 30 versions of this remarkable little book, which I find staggering. I didn't know that. 30. Ranging from a Penguin classic to a new American version, which I've seen very recently, which has attempted to render the Buddha's words in more politically correct and inclusive language. Interesting. Whether that's a good thing or not, I don't know. My first encounter with the text was the Penguin version. I don't know if you're familiar with this. I can't remember. I couldn't find a copy here at Padmaloka, and I can't remember the translator.
One Master.
That's it. But it was one of the first Buddhist scriptures that I looked at as a beginner, probably over 30 years ago. And I must admit, I wasn't particularly impressed by it. Now, that may have been to do with the translation, I don't know. But I think I made the dreadful mistake of thinking that because I could superficially read and understand the words, and the words are very clear, direct and self-evident, because I thought I could understand the words, there was little to gain from reading it more than once. How wrong could I have been? A glaring example of the difficulty of turning knowing into being. I thought knowing meant being. If I could read and understand the words, finished. Not so. Now I find, counting up, and again this was a surprise, now I find I've got 9 different versions of the text. Why, you may ask, why on earth has he got 9 copies of the Dhammapada, different copies of the Dhammapada? Isn't that a bit excessive? You know, I mean, surely one would do. But I work on the basis that words are symbols. Axioms and aphorisms are symbols. Symbols point beyond themselves, so it's very difficult to pin them down. The best approach with symbols is to keep asking yourself over and over, repeatedly, what else can it mean? So the more interpretations, the better. So if you've got more than one translation, it means you can actually compare them. And one person will translate a word such, another person will translate it differently. And it doesn't mean that one is right and one is wrong. It's like there are different shades of meaning. So, for instance, you need really a copy like the Narada translation, because it includes the Pali text. So you can actually read the words in anglicised Pali, which is also very useful, because then when you look those words up in the Pali English dictionary, you find that like Dhamma and other such Buddhist terms, they've got all sorts of meanings. So it gets very interesting indeed. You're dealing with a set of poems in a way. It's much more like that. I've made a limited study from time to time over the years of 4 of them, and I've compared some of them against each other. I wouldn't say I've done a lot of that, but I've done it over a long period of time. So needless to say, the Dhammapada has become one of my favourite Buddhist texts. Some of the versions are small enough to carry in one's pocket, like this one. It's great. You can even slip it into your trousers, yeah, and it sort of doesn't take up any space at all. It's great. And I've done this myself with this version, and there's another version here that I scribbled all over. They're quite sort of small, and you can sort of make notes of them because there's lots of paper at the ends. I've read it on buses and trains and planes when I'm travelling, and I use it as a source of material for reflection. And I just keep reading it over and over again. You know, you're looking out the window and you get sort of nice and mellow, and then you just read a couple of verses and put the book down and think about it. It's a great thing to do when you're travelling. I love short, pithy axioms and aphorisms. I've been collecting them for years, but this is as near as I've got to what I'd like in one book. All the other stuff I've got, I mean, I've got various books with aphorisms in, but this is the best collection I've come across. As I got more involved in the FWBO and started reading Bhante and listening to his lectures, I slowly began to realise how important the Dhammapada is. Bhante's writings, right up until sort of the most recent books, are liberally peppered with quotations from the Dhammapada as he unfolds his vision of the Dharma. This is hardly surprising, since his own association with the text goes back over 60 years. In 1944, long before I was born even, Bhante bought a copy of the book, a copy of the Dhammapada from the bookshop of a Buddhist temple in Delhi. He later learned it off by heart in the original Pali, before he knew what the English meant, and he used to recite it out loud I can just imagine him sort of striding up the road, belting out the Pali at the top of his voice in India. Remarkable. He studied it with the venerable Jagdish Kashyap. I don't know whether he studied it specifically as the Dhammapada or as part of his Pali studies, because he studied Pali with Jagdish Kashyap. And he delivered seminars on it to his Indian students during the time of the mass conversion to Buddhism initiated by Dr. Ambedkar. So, I mean, even before he got back to the UK, he'd already sort of looked at it quite a lot, done quite a lot with it. Bhante led seminars here in the UK on various chapters of the Dhammapada during the 70s and 80s, and he completed his own full translation in the year 2000 at Guhyaloka. In the preface, he says, and I find this very interesting indeed, "I sometimes think that the Dhammapada contains, at least in principle, as much of the Buddha's teaching as most of us need to know in order to progress towards enlightenment." It's quite something to say. It's in a way saying it's all here. And if you read the thing, you'll find that all the major teachings are there. All the basic formulations are there. All the lists. It's a real treasure trove of Dharma. It's wonderful. So that's nearly 10 minutes of me rattling on. What I'd like to do is stop talking about me and the text and read you bits of it. So that's what I propose to do. So I sat down with the book and started going through and looking at what my favourite sections were. And you can see I've got all these little... it's very, very difficult to choose what I thought was the most important. So I'm just going to sort of wade into them for as long as time lasts me. Some of this you'll probably know very well, but like I said, it bears endless repetition, because then slowly, slowly it goes in. We learn our Buddhism, we learn our Dhamma, we learn our Pali like we learn a new language. We have to do things over and over again. It's not something we do with our brains. It's got to go much deeper than that. So the section of the pairs. I'll give you the verse numbers just in case some of you are really interested and you want to follow these verses up. Yeah. So this is verses 1 and 2 in the first section, the section of the pairs. "Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox." 2. "Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind." If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. Now, there's lots that I could sort of draw out of this. I mean, it's interesting for a start that Banti's translated the first word as experiences. Usually it's mental states, unskillful mental states, actually, in the first verse, and skillful mental states in the second verse. But Banti's translated it as experiences, which I think is quite interesting. But what I read from these two verses is all the stuff that comes out of Know Your Mind. Yeah, the Abhidharma comes out of these two verses. We need to know what's going on in our deeper recesses, not just what we think on the froth, on the top of our minds, our superficial thoughts, but our beliefs, because they're rooted in thought, inverted commas, yeah? And that's what we've got to get down to. It's not just what we think on the top of our and the top of our minds. We've got to get down to what we believe, what actually motivates us. And it's thoughts, yeah? It's experiences. And everything else comes from that. Our speech and our acts come from our deeper beliefs. And very often that's all they are, comparing beliefs with faith, which is quite a different thing. So there's a lot I could say about that. Over the page, in the section of the pairs, verse 6. I've always been quite interested in communication. Probably if you know me, you realise that. But this is a particularly important one, I think. Verse 6, others do not realise that we are all heading for death. Those who do realise it will compose their quarrels. It's a very important verse, I think. We haven't got time to disagree with each other and find fault with each other and quarrel. It's a complete waste of time. We're heading for death. There isn't a moment to lose. And all this, you know, differences of opinion, usually over likes and dislikes, which again are the top of the mind, yeah? It's superficial froth. That's usually why we have our quarrels, and we waste our time with this when we could actually be getting on with cooperating in extremely important matters. So again, a lot I could say about that. Moving on. I'll come back to that maybe if I've got time. Section 2, verse 21. Mindfulness is the way to the immortal. Unmindfulness, the way to death. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead. I find that really stark. The unmindful are like the dead. Yeah? They don't know where they are, they don't know what they're doing, and they don't know where they're going. They don't know why they're here, even. Yeah? There are all sorts of fundamental questions that they haven't actually asked themselves. And it's very important that we ask ourselves these questions, otherwise we're rudderless. We don't know why we're here, we don't know where we're going. What are we going to do then? We just sort of faff about for four score years and ten, and then we die, and the opportunity is gone. Carrying on in this section, and the whole section is about, it's very much about mindfulness. Some of the sections deviate, and you get various themes in some sections, but the whole of the mindfulness section is very much about mindfulness, which, as I say, is something else that I've been very keen on throughout my Buddhist career, such as it is. Whether I've achieved much by it or not, I don't know. That's another question. Anyway, verse 29. Mindful among the unmindful, wide awake among the sleeping, the man of good understanding forges ahead like a swift horse outdistancing a feeble hack. I've always liked that sort of little image of, you know, like a real thoroughbred horse just, you know, and it leaves, you know, sort of... The knobbly old wreck for the knacker's yard way behind. It's off and gone. Wonderful. Pardon? That verse will not be in the politically correct version. No, I doubt it very much. Verse 31 in the same section. The almsman, brackets bhikkhu, who delights in mindfulness and who regards unmindfulness with fear advances like fire, burning up fetters gross and subtle. 32, the almsman who delights in mindfulness and who regards unmindfulness with fear is not liable to regression. He is in the presence of nirvana. I mean, maybe that's going a bit far for the likes of us, but, we don't regard unmindfulness with fear. It's just that, you know, when we're unmindful, it's a laugh, isn't it? We make a joke of it. But actually, we should be terrified. Every time we make a lapse of mindfulness, we're slipping and we're in trouble, yeah? If we can regard mindfulness like that, then we burn up our fetters like fire. I love that image of just sort of burning up the fetters. Again, something very fast. I don't know if you've ever seen like forest fires out of Gukyaloka. It's like, it's so fast fire. It's incredible. What else have I got? Lots of these images I find very sort of moving. They're very poignant, and they're as alive today as they were, was it 2,500 years ago? It's incredible. So this is from the section of the flowers, verse 47. As a great flood carries away a sleeping village, so death bears off the man who, possessed of longing, plucks only the flowers of existence. So again, a magnificent, I mean, a rather sort of poignant image, actually, given the things that have happened with the tsunami and the stuff that's been going on in New Orleans. A great flood carries away a sleeping village. It's just like, and it's gone, you know. That's what death is like, and it's coming. It's like an express train bearing down on us. We haven't got a moment to lose. And we need to look those headlights full in the face and decide what we're going to do. Otherwise, you know, the decades slip by. I used to think the years slip by, but I've been at Padmaloka now, nearly 18 years, and it's like 18 years. I feel like I've only just got here, but that's nearly two decades have just gone, And the older you get, the more that sense of time passing, because you can see the wrinkles and the hairs going grey, and you can't see quite so well, and things happen to your bladder, and you think, oh God, it's all breaking down. So it's no good just plucking the flowers of existence. Some more images from the same section, verse 49. Let the silent sage move about in the village as the bee goes, taking honey from the flower without harming colour or fragrance. It's a lovely image, the bee just sort of passing from flower to flower. But he doesn't damage anything. Nothing is spoiled. In fact, if anything, he's pollinating, isn't he, the bee? You could say that the silent sage is spreading the pollen of the Dharma even. Verse 50. One should pay no heed to the faults of others, what they have done and not done. Rather should one consider the things that one has oneself done and not done. Again, a very important one in terms of communication. It's so much easier to see the faults out there in the other person. Yeah, it's glaringly obvious what's wrong with them, but we don't know ourselves. Yeah, so that's why we need spiritual friends. We need spiritual friends to tell us what we're really like in an honest kind of way, without any malice, so that we actually know what we look like from the outside. It's so easy to get a sort of a sense of oneself from within that's completely completely wrong, basically. Very, very easy indeed. We'll leave those because I'm running out of time rapidly. So I need to edit even a bit more tightly. Ah, this is a particular favourite of mine. This is from the section on evil, verse 121 and 122. Do not underestimate evil, thinking, it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the spiritually immature person, little by little, fills himself with evil. 122. Do not underestimate good, thinking, it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the wise man, little by little, fills himself with good. I love these two verses. It's interesting, this business of water dripping is it's an image that occurs throughout the Buddhist literature in the Mahayana and even in the Vajrayana. You'll find this image used again and again. It crops up in the life and liberation of Padmasambhava. As in an empty house, the raindrops slowly gather. So it's like if you pay attention to the little things, slowly, slowly you will dispense with evil and you will fill up with good. It's in the little things, it's the little details that we have to look to. Life is a procession of lots of little details. And if we think they're unimportant, again, we're making a very big mistake, because slowly, slowly they fill us up. It reminds me also of that, there's a line from a piece by Dogen where he talks about walking through drizzle. And it's not really very wet. If you hold your hand out, it doesn't get very wet. But as you walk through it, your clothes slowly get soaked and it soaks into you. And that's what it's like if you spend time with somebody who's unethical, unscrupulous, not to say evil. Slowly, slowly, although you're aware that they're evil, their evilness sort of soaks into you, little by little. So you have to be very, very careful indeed. I love those two verses. What else have I got? Ah, I thought I'd share with you these two. These are fun, I think. This is from the section on decay, verse 152. The man of little learning lives like a stalled ox. His flesh increases, but his wisdom does not. I find that very interesting in these days of increasing obesity in the population of the world, yeah, or certainly the Western world. Our flesh increases, but our wisdom does not, because we won't learn. And there's an echo of this further on in verse 325, page 109, which I'll read you, because again it's very funny. So this is from the section of the elephant, verse 325. One who is sluggish and gluttonous, given to sleep, and a roller about like a great hog fed on grains, such a stupid person goes again and again to a womb to be reborn. Yeah? Again, so in the face of death, we roll about in our stall like a great hog fed on grain. No, thank you, if I can help it. Good heavens. Right, I should get ready to finish. There were all sorts of other things I wanted to share with you. There are the echoes of shunyata is mentioned in the Dhammapada. Lots of people say, oh, there's none of this emptiness in the Pali Canon. But it's in the Dhammapada you'll find emptiness, shunya, in the Pali Canon, in the Dhammapada. And lots of other things besides, all sorts of teachings which occur throughout the Pali Canon, as I say, throughout Buddhist literature generally, very often the roots are in the Dhammapada. So just a couple of things I want to finish off with. I hope that's given you the slightest taste of what this little gem is worth. I found this. I can't remember where I got this, but it's very good. And it's by somebody called Buddharakita. As far as I know, this is Bhante's friend who he went on walkabout with, and the one who punched him in the face. I don't know, but if it was him, he certainly moved on. And he and he has this. He has this to say about the Dhammapada. And again, a lot of the things I've said, he sums up really beautifully here. As a great religious classic and the chief spiritual testament of early Buddhism, the Dhammapada cannot be gauged in its true value by a single reading, even if that reading is done carefully and reverentially. It yields its riches only through repeated study, sustained reflection, and most importantly, through the application of its principles to daily life. Thence it might be suggested to the reader in search of spiritual guidance that the Dhammapada be used as a manual for contemplation. After his initial reading, he would do well to read several verses or even a whole chapter every day, slowly and carefully, relishing the words. He should reflect on the meaning of each verse deeply and thoroughly investigate its relevance to his life and apply it as a guide to conduct. If this is done repeatedly with patience and perseverance, it is certain that the Dhammapada will confer upon his life a new meaning and sense of purpose. Infusing him with hope and inspiration, gradually it will lead him to discover a freedom and happiness far greater than anything the world can offer. I think that's a brilliant summing up of the Dhammapada. And I'd just like to finish with some lines from Bhante, from Pieces of Fire. Bhante says of the Dhammapada this: "The teachings contained in the Dhammapada are literal truth and deserve to be engraved on our hearts in letters of gold or fire."